Adobe.co. This is the Flagship Pod, a weekly podcast about the stock market, the economy, and the various market forces powering the world around you. I'm your host, Peter Starr. Bringing you this time another edition of our interview series, I had a chance to talk with Brooks Addington, the CEO of Toast Beverage. Toast is a really cool non-alcoholic wine-adjacent drink, and the brand has actually been around for 7 years in the non-alcoholic space, going through this new uptick we've seen. This is a great conversation because it's going to give you a better sense of what's happening in the CPG space as brands try to navigate all of the really complicated issues surrounding shipping and branding, and trying to understand what the uptick in non-alcoholic beverages has been so far. It's a really exciting conversation, so you know what, let's just go ahead and jump right into it. And so now I'm joined by Brooks Addington, CEO of Toast Beverages, talking about the non-alcoholic beverage space and getting a better understanding of the new sort of CPG meta we're seeing in this market. So Brooks, man, thank you so much for joining us. Where are you calling from, man?
Oh, thank you, Peter. We're excited to be here and speak with you and to your audience. I'm in Vermont, cold Vermont here. Not born and raised here, but this is where HQ is now, and pretty cool state to be running a business in.
Especially in developing something as interesting as Toast Beverage. So Brooks, let me help my audience get a better sense of what's happening in the non-alcoholic beverage space. So tell me about Toast first, real quick.
Yeah, so we've been around for 7 years. We were a little early to the game, and so obviously, you know, seen a lot transpire over these 7 years, and certainly the last few. You know, Toast is a sparkling alcohol-free beverage that is wine adjacent, really. A product that we created for those occasions where you might want something more, something that's sophisticated and meaningful, but doesn't necessarily have any alcohol in it. And so you can think about certainly holiday periods, but, you know, a lot of which is becoming into the moderation play. You know, in the past, there really weren't a lot of options. As people know, you know, you might go to a party and want to drink, maybe having a ginger ale or a sparkling water or a soda. And there's been a massive boom in the creation of non-alcoholic beverages. You know, beer has significantly improved the process to make it, you know, pretty much like beer. Great products out there. And in our case, the de-alcoholization of wine remains to be, I think, somewhat of a challenge. And so we've created a beverage that is not de-alcoholized wine, but rather a tea-based sparkling beverage that can be an adjacent to that occasion. We're very occasion-focused. So anytime you'd want something where, you know, you don't necessarily want alcohol, but you want an elevated beverage, you're eating food, you're at a restaurant, you're at a party, you're not necessarily looking to drink, you know, Toast is a great option.
Exactly. And what's really interesting about that to us, too, is just how mature you are in the space already. You've been doing this for 7 years. Like, Toast really got here very early to the process. So you've also seen a lot of different metas in the CPG space, too. I'm sure you saw just like the cheap capital mayhem that washed across CPG as we ramped up into like 2019 and 2020. Obviously, now things are a little bit more difficult. Take me through establishing your niche in this space as well, trying to understand exactly where you fit in. So, like, was it an advantage at first being one of very few non-alcoholic brands? Like, did you have to sort of market as an alcohol adjacent brand, or how did you establish this in the beginning here? Like, how's that marketing situation work out?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I've said for a long time, it's not terribly difficult to launch in this day and age, maybe a little bit harder today than it was a few years ago when all that capital was free flowing, but, you know, pretty easy to start a business in the CPG space. You come up with an idea, you find a co-packer, you can get test cans out pretty easily. You can get people to make a flavor for you. That's the easy part. And you can probably go sell it locally and get people to try it, but it's the repetitive piece that really matters. And to scale a business, you know, the more money you have, the more stores you can get into, the more you can promote it. But at the end of the day, if the beverage doesn't taste good, eventually consumers will catch on and there won't be that secondary sale. And there you go. So we knew very early on pre-launch that we had a high likability with the beverage just from our own internal testing. And we'd done a soft launch. And so for us, it was really in the early days. And we started with effectively almost no capital, very much friends and family out of the back of the car, store by store. But what we knew was that the product was selling in those stores and that people were coming back for more. And so for us in the early days, it was, let's really just push that old school, pick up a store, service them, get another one, get the word out, very organic. You know, being in New England, there's, you know, a lot of pride in New England products, being in Vermont for sure. So we had that local excitement that people were willing to at least give it a try. And then we had the beverage behind it that really supported it. So we really just grew from that organically. I think we started in 2017. We were in 100 stores by the end of the year, 400 by 2018. And we just kind of kept piling on and piling on regionally, and then a little bit of national, a little bit of international, and off we went. What we did not do was follow the path of trying to do discovery online, because of the high cost of entry for that. So we preferred saying, we know people like the taste of the beverage. We know there's a high likability and the chances of someone trying it will be a repeat. We also have a product that is what we term, you know, affordable luxury. So it's under $10 for a 750 milliliter bottle. It's very approachable. People can afford that, pay for it, and not feel like they're taking a huge risk. So the combination of the two was really important for us, having a product that tastes great and having a community of people that were willing to try it because it was local, and then having a price point that was not going to break the bank on people. Those three together really put us in a strong position to start winning share.
And that's one of those things too. It's like perfect incremental story. Obviously, it's super impressive that you were able to resist the mania of cheap capital as Toast was starting out. And just at the same time, not just taking it too slow too, like getting to 100 stores in your first year and 400 by the second. That's not even slow growth. That's still pretty breakneck pace for an organic growth strategy. So that's just a testament to the product itself and testament to the team too. As you've reached a new kind of inflection point in your growth, have you seen this accelerate because, you know, you're at a critical mass now, or do you see like a lot more broader interest in the non-alcoholic space? Are you getting lift from the wider popularity of like non-alcoholics in general, or is it just the power of the product itself that you think is still just guiding your growth path as you move through here?
Well, compound interest is powerful, as you know, Peter. And so, you know, those numbers start to really matter in the back end as opposed to the front end in terms of growth and value. So we're seeing that with the product. We're just scale really matters, and our ability to, you know, if we go from 100 stores to 400 is, you know, quite different than going from 2000 to 5000, right? So we're starting to see that scale. But absolutely, the boom in non-alcoholic, the marketplace, the category has certainly fueled us. I mean, us being early and be able to show partners and big partners, distributors and large retailers, that we have back data, that we have proof that this will sell, that we have got longevity, that we're not going to disappear in 6 months, that we have the right backing financially to continue to service them, because no one wants to invest in a brand that then disappears. All of that has really helped. And you couple on top of that, this massive non-alc movement where virtually every retailer and now pretty much all the major restaurant chains and conglomerates recognize they need to have a solution here. And so being a product, again, that has a high likability, that has a compelling price point, becomes very attractive to all those parties. Plus the fact, again, that we've been around for a long time. So that is, I mean, there are absolutely conversations that we have in the last year that were just simply would not have happened 2 years ago. And especially on the distributor side, where a lot of the alcohol distributors really weren't convinced that non-alc was worth the investment. They were just watching quietly. And then they saw the success of Athletic. And I think that, and then obviously all the media and the boom and the statistics and everyone's jumping on board. So our network of distribution has changed dramatically over the last 18 months, really, I think, because there's buy-in on the space.
And I think that's going to be something I'm going to explore a lot more later on, because that adds into such a huge issue of complexity, trying to understand how you logistically kind of handle the new meta right now, given just the difficulties with how expensive shipping is, sort of the returns you need to get every time you ship. Like, you can't ship one bottle at a time. You really do have to rely on sort of like bulk ordering and, you know, relying on distributors without it sort of like eating into your costs. And that's a really fascinating dynamic that our audience really wants to understand, as well as they get a better sense of the efficiencies people need to be successful in the CGP space. Let me just pump the brakes real fast just so we get a better sense of the Toast profile as well. Just out of curiosity, like based on the back data you have, what demographics are you working the best with right now? Is it kind of like similar to wine drinkers, or are there any interesting patterns in the data that you see that you've been kind of fascinated by as the brand has developed?
We feel very fortunate that we have a very diverse demographic that enjoys Toast, and it really is across all generations. Now, why does a boomer not drink versus an X versus a millennial versus a Z? They're all different reasons. I mean, Zs are just flat out drinking less. There's plenty of data out there, and your listeners can find it quite easily to see that there's the drinking's down, you know, double digit percentages in terms of people regularly drinking. I'll give you a stat. This is not a US thing either, by the way. I'll give you a Japan stat that, you know, 15 years ago, the number of 20 somethings that consider themselves regular drinkers was something around 30, whatever you define regular drinker as. And last year it was at 9%. So, you know, the Zs are clearly drinking less, but the boomers are also getting older and want to drink less, and recognizing that the heavy alcohol intake that they've lived through over decades is catching up on them. You know, X's, we're all more, I'm an X, we're all, you know, recognizing that health matters, millennials and everything. So one is we see likability across. We have a brand that, you know, really reaches a lot of different people. We're also demographically, we do really well in Florida. We do well in the Pacific Northwest. We do well urban and rural. We're in Iceland. We're in Korea. We're in Nigeria. We're in Mexico, Canada, some Eastern European countries down in the islands, USVIs, Barbados. So we're really proud of the fact that the brand itself speaks to a lot of different people. And then lastly, age-wise, I mean, if we go off social, we're 45% in that, you know, 24 to 45 range, and then 12% below, 12% above that, 12, you know, another 10% above the next decade. And then skew female, 58, 42-ish, kind of rate, 60-40, depending on the time of year. We're pretty excited about our demographic and the fact that we do reach a lot of groups, and we're not limited to coastal, urban, or only rural, et cetera, that we're really, really touching a lot of different people. That puts us in a very strong position to be a beverage that has high likability across a broad audience, and that becomes very attractive to our partners that want to obviously sell product and make money.
And that's huge, too. And it's a really great way of understanding the game you're trying to play in terms of getting to that next level of scale, because you've already gone global. And so there's like a million different paths you can take as you develop that network, too. And having such a broad demographic base where, you know, your bell curve is right, is basically just saddled dead on millennials. I'm a millennial myself, and we see the exact same trends, right?
Yeah, I think there's also the social acceptance of all of it that has changed. You know, the Mad Men era of having a couple of martinis at lunch, coming back and, you know, writing a letter and taking a nap on the couch. Think about the productivity that each one of your listeners does in a given day versus what they could have done 50 years ago. That era is over. And so the stigma of saying, well, I'm not going to go out this week because I'm not drinking, people just go out. And, you know, quite frankly, I saw an article this morning. I think it said the cannabis business was $30 billion now in the U.S. 22 states in the United States are recreational legal. So you have people looking for other options that are, you know, arguably healthier than alcohol to relax or enjoy or socialize. The landscape is changing dramatically and quite rapidly. And there have been products out there that are, you know, in our case is a good example. You know, we've been there and we've been reaching the crowd, but the adoption of the product and the occasions have increased because our social construct of having to have a cocktail have changed. It's exciting to see that that's all dissipated for the most part, and that people, sometimes they drink, sometimes they don't. I mean, I go out all the time and we've got lots of friends that don't drink or might not be drinking that day, and no one really seems to care anymore, which is pretty cool.
And not only that, but like every restaurant has just absolutely massively expanded their non-alcoholic beverage offerings as well. Like, it's not just social acceptance too. It's sort of this new sort of ecosystem building around it as well. And that's just like great to understand the trends there. But let's get down into more of the business side here as well. Like, you've gotten to the scale where you're shipping a very heavy product basically as far as Korea, like literally, you know, almost the opposite side of the world if you've got customers in Australia. So just looking through those dynamics, it has been absolutely nuts in the past 4 years, just with the supply chains collapsing in 2020 and the build back up across 2021 and 2022. How have you been managing to weather that storm? Like, how has it changed your outlook in terms of, I need to get these products to as many places as possible? Has that hindered your growth prospects or the advantages you have here with all of the distributors you work with? Has that been a situation where you've been able to drive efficiencies?
Yeah, I mean, the COVID shock, and certainly with shipping, was difficult. And we'd increase our pricing along with pretty much everybody else. And I think our increases probably weren't as dramatic, but, you know, really the big expense for us is glass. I mean, it's a heavy unit. We got to make it, ship it, fill it, and then ship it, you know, with all the liquid inside of it. So, you know, we did some price increases during COVID. We've been able to really maintain that. And prices have come down actually in shipping. Again, shipping being a major cost for us. So with some of the price dropping there, we've been able to source, you know, better glass. And we've been able to ship product around the world and make better margin for customers. I mean, I think freight from Asia and freight from you know, across the Atlantic, both have come down significantly compared to 2025, you know, 2020. And I can't remember exact numbers, but I know that 2019 to 2020 containers were, you know, 4 or 5x. So if they've halved since then, we're still making a ton of progress. And then really, you know, for us, again, really important for us to be at a price point that is competitive. As we grow, you know, our ability to see some discounts in buying more materials, doing larger runs, shipping more product. You ship a pallet of product out west, you know, you might be paying $7, $8, $9 a case. But if you can go ship 4 or 5 pallets, you're down to, you know, 3 or 4. And that's a significant cost savings for a product like ours. So we are always looking to structure deals with our distributor partners where we're shipping more at a time. We're looking at warehousing and production in different parts of the country over time. And then working with our partners that supply all of our ingredients and all of our packaging to really try to get to a place where we're maximizing efficiencies. And that's really the game. And that's the game, as you know, Peter, in any industry, as you scale, is trying to find those efficiencies that will improve margin for yourself and for your partners. But without a doubt, the biggest impact has just been the reduction in shipping lanes. You know, one of the other challenges of going overseas is interest rates. I'm not sorry, interest rates, but foreign exchange. And we're seeing this in Asia right now with the US dollar strength versus some of the Asian currencies make it difficult to bring product over. I mean, this is basic macroeconomics, right? So, you know, we may see a dip in some of the business over there because all of a sudden our product is 25 or 30% more expensive. Even though the shipping rates have come down, you have a weaker currency. It costs you that much more to bring it on shore. And all of a sudden, you know, you're a little bit more expensive than you want to be. So we're juggling all of that. And ultimately, the goal is to be able to produce around the world and really become more local. So you reduce all that movement, which is really a huge cost for us.
Exactly. That was going to be kind of my next question too. Just, we used the Korea example. When I was working in Korea, it was like a dead on 1-to-1, 1,000 won to $1 type situation. And you're dealing with 1,300, like it's gone up 30% in like literally 3 years. And that is an interest rate function. Like the US dollar has strengthened out of control. How do you even like deal with that? Is that just one of those things where you like brand yourself more as a luxury product and increase prices abroad? Or is there anything else you can do to sort of like mitigate all of that truly insane Forex pressure right now?
Well, we're feeling the Forex pressure without a doubt. And I think part of it is, you know, if we start, this is a great example, if we start producing on the West Coast and we can ship out of the West Coast, we're not going to have to send containers through the canal. And all of a sudden you're reducing that case cost and getting yourself back to par. So, you know, you try to get closer and closer to the source to reduce that, right? You know, we eventually want to produce in Asia, for example, and have already started having some of those conversations. You know, it's down the road for us, but it's, you know, we want to prepare ahead. For a business like ours and the size like ours, there's not a lot we can do except just try to maintain those pricing when you're talking about 30% swings, right? There's just, you know, if you go into a family that's in Japan, and I spent 15 years over there, and my wife was back there this past Christmas, and she said that the local liquor stores are really not selling a lot of California wine right now. They're really pushing the local wine and a lot of sake. And the reason is very clear, that that bottle of wine that was, you know, 1800 yen is now 2700 yen. People are not going to pay 2700 yen for it. So you can only do so much. And, you know, I think a part of the importance of that is for a company to be diversified with a lot of different revenue channels. If our business was solely predicated on the success of Asia, we'd be in a lot of trouble right now.
And that's pretty huge too, to get to understand that. So hopefully, you know, we're going to see interest rates go down this year. We're going to see the US dollar, you know, weaken a little bit to sort of juice those numbers. But it's exciting that you're considering that local production side of things. Just getting the canal out of the way, especially with the Panama Canal being a little backed up still with...
I mean, you know, that container went sideways in the Suez 2 years ago and caused all sorts of problems. And so, you know, there's a lot of... And this is a whole different conversation with CPG, but we rely on, you know, two avenues of moving a lot of goods around the world that are at risk. You know, the canal, both those canals, Suez and Panama, if you plug those up, you're going to cause a lot of cost problems and supply chain problems for a long time. So we look at long-term geopolitical risk as well, and wanting to be able to diversify our risk by sourcing in multiple countries and producing, you know, in different places around the globe.
Of course. And that's why we have conversations like this, because yes, we're talking CPG, but CPG touches everything, like everything else in the economy. So I really appreciate you, you know, feeling comfortable going far afield as well. So when we look at that, I guess just one last thing, just out of curiosity. So our audience is always just trying to understand how promotion works in this space as well. Like the incremental model works great. Just get into stores, have a good product, get into people's hands, and the rest kind of takes care of itself. Did you ever feel any of that pressure to go full D2C for any period during this development, especially when rates were lower, capital was super cheap, and, you know, the algorithms were a lot cheaper to advertise on? Or did you always kind of resist that pressure since, you know, you want to sell on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And again, you know, we launched in a large 750 milliliter bottle format. And if you think about it, you know, the things priced at $9, for example, if you try to ship a single bottle from the East Coast to the West Coast, it's probably going to cost you more than $9. So there really was, first of all, we were forced into selling larger quantities of product. And we realized pretty early on that the product was not going to be discovery on DTC without spending a ton of money. And I had a background with some other products that were consumer facing, weren't food and beverage. In the past, it worked in Amazon and other online, and it's had some experience about what those costs can be. And so we really early on said, you know, we want to be available DTC. We want people that know the product, and they say, hey, you know what? I know the product and I buy it in New York, but I'm going out to Virginia and I don't know if I'm going to have it out there. So I'm going to go buy myself a case and have it shipped down. And that was kind of what we did. When COVID hit, we definitely invested in DTC. We lowered our shipping costs, increased our pricing. At the end of the day, there's no free lunch. And, you know, we're not just too expensive to give away free shipping. So people don't want to pay for shipping. We increased the price, lower the actual shipping charge, kind of landed a similar cost and margin. And we did some investing in the website itself, but there was so much discovery going on by people at the time that we didn't really have to, we weren't trying to fight for it. We invest in Google and things like that, defend our position when people look up Toast at the top of the page, but we've never really gone after this DTC discovery model. And really gone with, like, we love events. We send out a lot of samples to a lot of people. We love giving out product to people because we believe in the sips to lips concept versus telling a great story on Instagram and having a $20, you know, charge per person to discover, you know, or 30 or more. We just never played that game. We just felt like it was a losing proposition for us in particular. Now, I know brands have been very successful doing it. They've spent a lot. They've used it to launch. And some brands have been able to use that data to then get into the bricks and mortar. But that game has changed a lot as well. And post-COVID, a bunch of brands have been caught out with, hey, I've got this audience and it's pretty decent. And here are the data. Let me go into the store. And that's just it's not crossover. It's not happening as much as people had hoped. And so, you know, we are on DTC. We're available. You can buy 3 bottles at a time, you know, but the majority of our business is that sort of 6 and 12 bottle, you know, returning customer who knows the product. And quite frankly, the margin's better if people go buy in a store. So we'd rather have the distributor make money, the store make money, have us make money. Everyone is motivated, as opposed to us just try to fight for, you know, DTC space on Meta and other platforms that have gotten quite expensive to capture customers. So we are a company that wants to make money and that is working hard to do that and to have longevity with that. And so arguably you might sacrifice some growth to an early on to get there, but I think we're seeing with our patients that return happening now and sticking with our process of sips to lips, you know, get in front of people, have them taste it and kind of go old school on it.
And, you know, that's just a demonstration of the classic principles, right? Like business is better done together. And it's really important to see that, like, the way our market really thinks is we're still kind of addicted to that 2010s mentality that, like, I need to be the winner who takes everything. I need to just go super fast, get as big as possible, I'll build this gigantic digital audience, and then I'll figure it out. Whereas if you sort of like put down actual roots, turns out, you know, plants grow from the root upwards as opposed to from, like, you know, the leaf downwards. So it's really cool seeing those principles play out even in this market moment and seeing that multivariate strategy play out as well. So this has been a really awesome conversation and I've appreciated your time, Brooks. I don't want to take up too much. Anything else you want our audience to think about from the CPG space, from Toast, as we sort of like wrap this up here? Anything you think we missed in the conversation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's been great and interesting and, you know, I don't often get to talk about the business side of things. It's usually about the brand. So, and I'm a finance guy at heart from my background. So I enjoy these types of conversations, but I just, you know, please go check out our product, toastbeverages.com. We've got a good finder online and we're most likely, I mean, we're in pretty much every state now and we're in, you know, about 12,000 doors. So we're probably somewhere near you and we'd love for you to go in locally and buy some product and give us a try. And let us know what you think. But, you know, excited to be here. Appreciate the time, Peter. And thank you.
And once again, thanks so much to Brooks Addington for coming on to the show. Again, folks, check out Toast. See if they're in your area at toastbeverages.com. Otherwise, just keep in mind that there are so many little complexities powering this global economy and powering all these different shifts. And I'm really glad we got a chance to get a better sense of the on-the-ground look here from an actual brand trying to make it work both domestically and internationally with something as expensive as glass bottles, right? Either way, folks, that's going to be a good place for us to end it here. Just so you know, this podcast is produced, hosted, and voiced by me, Peter Starr. If you ever have any questions for us, you can email our team at hello@mobi.co. Otherwise, check us out over on Instagram to see our more on-the-ground reporting as we get a better sense of the economy day by day. Regardless, folks, that's a good place for us to end it. So as always, we'd like to leave you with peace, love, and incremental gains. Everyone be well. Thank you so much.